Good afternoon. This is Lori Atkins of South Texas Archives, Pat Allison, who is our writer in residence, and Larry Running Turtle Salazar, who is a Native American, here today to talk to us about his history. It is July 20th, 2017, and we are at South Texas Archives at Texas A&M University, Kingsville. Running Turtle, would you like to begin?
Thank you. My name is Larry Running Turtle Salazar. What I just did right there is, before I announce or speak of my people, it is traditional as a traditionalist to always bring in the spirit people of the four directions and to place a prayer upon this land that I'm standing on right now and to bring healing to it and to the people within this recording and also within an earshot from where we're standing right now. It was a prayer that I speak of my people and that everything is taken in a good way.
Very nice. Thank you. We'd like you to talk about any of the memories and stories that your mother told you and or other relatives about, and just tell us more about your heritage.
I am of Nende and Salagi descent, which is Apache and Cherokee descent. My mother was full-blood Cherokee. Our seventh generation grandmother went off the Trail of Tears and into Texas, among many other Cherokee people that had done the same thing. And when they came into Texas, they changed their last name only to protect their identity. And in my case, my relatives were named Glory back then. When they came into Texas, they changed their name to Gloria. And that is the name that my seventh generation's grandmothers took on up until my mother. She was born in Houston, Texas, and she struggled very harshly, as you can imagine, in the in those times. Being Indian wasn't very easy for her, as it has been since 1492. It's been a very difficult life, and it's been a very secret life for many years. All the teachings that she received when she was younger were done very silently, or in the darkness of night, or behind the shed, or somewhere away from everybody. This was the only ways that our people can keep our traditions and our teachings going forth. We moved down here from, I was born in San Antonio. My mother gave birth to me, and there was no midwife. There was nothing, just her giving birth to my older brother, Ernest Gray Wolf, and my sister Judy, who we were all born by her. And my brother and my sisters experienced my father, my biological father, but he left my mother 2 weeks before I was born, so I didn't get a chance to meet him or see him. But there was no records written and nothing. My mother only had a third grade education, so she did not know how to read or write. She just gave birth to us and 2 days later went back to work, you know.
Was your father Native American also?
He was Apache. He was Nende. He was the Apache one. And I didn't get to meet him Met him one time, but I'll talk about that a little bit later, during my mother's, right after my mother had passed away. But my mother struggled with us when we came to Corpus Christi, which was 1962, the summer of 1962. I was 7 years old at the time, and I was just fast approaching the first grade. And first day of school, they took me into, after enrollment, they marched me to the office. And it was a room about as big as this one. And they sat a chair right in the center, and there was a desk there. And a principal came in, I believe his name was Mr. Brown at the time, and he came in and he closed the door, and he had a little machine in his hand, and he cut my hair off completely. And it didn't bother me any. I was just 7 years old. What do I care, you know? I now look like everybody else. And to me, that was somewhat important at that time. And they wrote my mother a note, but my mother couldn't read it. So she had to ask her neighbors to read the letter for her. And it said something about that I could not speak my language, and that I couldn't wear long hair anymore. And I had a medicine bag on me, and they took that away from me, and they said that she needed to come to the office to pick it up. And they said that I could only be Larry Salazar. I could not be Yacajel Chostil, which is Running Turtle. And my mother was very upset about that, and they told her also that I couldn't dress the way I was dressing. Heaven knows what I was wearing at that time, because I was just 7 years old. But my mother tried to mock them, I guess, either mock them or mock me. I don't know what she was doing, but she took me to a Goodwill industry, and she bought a lot of little suits for me to wear. And I wore suits from the first grade to the sixth grade, while everybody else did not have to. But she wanted me so much to look like the principal. So this is the way I was dressed, and the kids would make fun of me, you know, because of the way I was dressed, and so on and so forth. And it was very difficult for me, because I was stuck between two worlds, if you will. Very, very stuck between two worlds. It was very difficult for me, hard to understand, you know. And my mother would try to, at the dead of night, talk to me the way her parents talked to her. Her mother would talk to her and teach her the ways, along with my brothers and my sisters.
Would your mother talk in a native language?
She didn't know her language very well, the Salagic language, but she knew some of the Apache language. Okay. Through my father. And I didn't learn my Apache language from any of my relatives. I learned the Apache language as growing up and going to ceremonies. I speak four languages, and I'm self-taught in all of them. But I couldn't use any of those, in only the English language. And so it was it was kind of neat, because, you know, I would go to school and learn to read and write, and I couldn't wait to get home to learn the ways of my people, you know. But I was also stuck between another world, and that was the world of the martial arts that I started when I was 7 years old. And that's pretty much where I basically got my discipline from. I've learned a lot of my mannerisms and a lot of my discipline and a lot of my spirituality through the martial arts. I studied with a Korean master in San Antonio by the name of Kim Soo. And then when there was no school in the summers, I would take a bus back to San Antonio, stay with my cousins there, and go to Kim Soo's school, which was Murukwan, Korean Art of Fighting. But back then, in the 60s, it was a very secretive art, not like it is today. Today is very... it's no longer a martial art. Now it's a commercial art, you know, and it's a way of making money for for the teachers, and back then it wasn't like that. So I was stuck between these three worlds, the world that they wanted me to grow up to be in, the educational world, the martial art world, which I did that for 48 years, and then the ways of the Native people, my people. And I remember when I was, I met my girlfriend, I met it, my first girl that I ever met, that I ever dated, I ended up marrying her. I met her in the eighth grade, but she was a Catholic, and I was 15 years old when I met her, and I was only baptized when I was a young man, a child. So I was baptized August the 2nd, I used to know the year, 1957, I believe it was. And that's all I had in Catholicism. But when I met her, her mother, father, the whole family were all very religious, and they all went to Catholic schools. So I told my mom and dad, I was raised by a stepfather, that I wanted to learn how to become a Catholic. I said, well, go ahead. So I had no support from them, but I went to catechism, and I did all my sacraments, and without the support of my parents or anybody, I was baptized and everything. I'm not baptized, but I remember being in church, and all the other kids were all small, and I was the only tall one, you know, getting my first confirmations and my, you know, all that stuff that you had to have. I literally have done all seven sacraments. There's seven sacraments within a Catholic. The seventh one, I've done it twice. And most Catholic, are you, y'all in Catholic, are y'all?
No.
And most Catholic people, when you say you've done the seventh one, they're like, what do you mean by that? The seventh one is the anointment of the death. And I've literally died and came back twice. I passed away and come back twice. So I tell everybody that I've done my seventh sacrament twice. They're not ready for me. So that was my pathway of Catholicism, and I'm still Catholic, and I also studied Buddhism. All of these were choices that I made on my own. Everything that I've ever gotten into, everything that I've ever been involved in, have been the some choices that I have made throughout my life. And it was always for something to become better than what I was the day before or yesterday for myself.
You wrote the book, The Pipe and the Pen, and it tells about your blending of spirituality among the different cultures that you studied. The Indian culture, which is what you are, the Catholic and the Buddhism. So you would say you have a belief in all three that are twined together?
I do. I cover all my bases. I'm trying to anyway. So, you know, and it to me, it's like, but this is just me. Let me rephrase that. I love the compassion side of Buddhism. I love the compassionate and the spiritual side of Catholics. You know, there's some things that I don't really agree with them, you know, but I don't have to, you know. It's not too much the Catholic. I'm not really wrapped up around the whole Catholic thing. It's more a doorway or a pathway, my connection to Christ, yeah. But I really, really bring it all together with the Native American teachings, you know, because I wake up every morning as I always have since I was a young man, and I go outside and I face the sun, because that's where we get our blessings from, the holy people, just as the sun is rising. And we play, I play my flute, or I play a song in my drum, and this is the way I pray in the morning and receive the blessings from the holy people. And no other religion really does that, when not from the ones that I studied. Maybe they are. I mean, I guess up in the Middle East and whatnot, they do the same thing too in their own ways. But I'm not too sure about those. Or I don't know anything about those. But I like this. I like the connection of Mother Earth. I like the connection of the animals. I like the condition of the four directions and the sun, the moon, the stars. All that just seems so right to me, you know. And then when I bring Christianity to it and bring Buddhism to it, it's just a world of goodness. How could you not? How could I not? You know, so I wrap myself around these all the time, and I search out day in, day out for spiritual teachings of these things.
You say that you are a wisdom seeker in the book. What is a wisdom seeker?
Well, that's what I don't say that about myself. That's what people have called me, because they're like, oh, you're here again? Are you here to seek out some more wisdom? I said, yeah, I am. So, you know, they had labeled me a long time ago as a wisdom seeker, because there was a time in my life where I wanted to wrap myself around so much knowledge, and I didn't graduate. I lacked a half a credit. A half a credit. And ask me why I lacked a half a credit. Because I didn't believe in government. So because I did not pass government, I didn't graduate. And I didn't care to. It didn't bother me. But I love the wisdom. I love the wisdom of the trees, the wisdom of the air, the wisdom of the spirit people. So I wanted to find out more about this. How do I do that? Am I going to sit around and wait for it to come to me? No. Life is what happens while you're making other plans. So I went out and seeked out my own wisdom. I had the opportunity, and I got to meet Dr. Wayne Dyer, if you all know who Dr. Wayne Dyer is or not. Got to talk to him, got to be with him. You know, it was such a beautiful experience. You know, we've lost him already, and I feel very sad about that. You know, I've got to meet and be with Deepak Chopra, you know, and that was an awesome feeling too. You know, it was a great spiritual teacher, you know, and I got to go and meet Thich Nhat Hanh, which is a Buddhist master teacher. He's like the Dalai Lama to the Tibetan monks, what he is to Buddhism as well. I met him in Paris, France, at Plum Village. And to be able to sit with him and talk to these spiritual masters is just an enormous, I'm like, pinch me, somebody pinch me. You know, and then I got to meet and actually sit and talk with the Dalai Lama, have an audience with him. You know, how many people do that? You know what I'm saying? You know, you hear what I'm saying? And it's like, wow. You know, you become what you think about. You know, you become what you think about. And I always thought about, I want to know this. You know, I would see somebody on television. I'll give you a funny story about that. And my wife can attest to this, you know. Every time I wanted to meet somebody or see somebody, all I had to do is send it out into the universe, and it would come to pass. The day that I the whole Steven Seagal thing, you know, I trained under him for 11 years. And somebody, I was teaching already Aikido. I was doing a system called Tumiki Aikido. And I wasn't too well pleased with it, but it was Aikido nonetheless that I had down here in South Texas. But I knew that there was a better type of Aikido. I just didn't know which one it was. And a gentleman comes by into my school, and I was teaching at the YMCA at the time, and he says, he had a shirt that said Steven Seagal on there. Well, I said, Aikido. I said, who's Steven Seagal? He said, it was funny you should ask. You need to go see his movie. It's just going to come out this coming Friday. I said, really? He says, yeah, it's a movie about Aikido. And they said, yeah. So I went to go see the movie, Above the Law, the very first movie, 1988. And I was sitting in the audience, and 10 minutes into the movie, I turned around and I looked at my wife and I said, he's going to be my teacher someday. And she's like, yeah, I believe you. And about 2 weeks later, I received a letter in the mail with airplane tickets to go to Los Angeles. He was opening up. He was just moving back into the United States because he was living in Osaka, Japan for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And he was opening up his first Aikido dojo in Santa Monica. So I was invited to go over there. He was inviting all Aikido practitioners throughout the United States. And I was one of the ones that he invited. And my God, I was there with him, you know. And he's primarily the one that lined me up and put me in the pathway of Buddhism. because he is what they call a toku. A toku is a, there's so many definitions for the word toku. It's a Tibetan word that means an empty vessel, or a vessel that has come back, or a reborn lama from many past lives. And anyway, so he's the one that put me on the pathway of Buddhism.
It's a great story. So did you continue on with the martial arts throughout your life?
Well, I did it for 48 years nonstop. I have a black belt in Muruguayan, I have a black belt in Judo, I have a black belt in Sabate, which is French foot fighting, and I have a black belt in Aikido. And everybody's like, wow, you got a black belt, you must be awesome, you know. Now, black belt, all it really means is that you got done with your basics, and everybody here in the United States has labeled it, oh, you must be Mr. Badass or you got a black belt. Doesn't mean nothing. It just means you got done with your basics. What you do after that is what really matters. You're striving to mastery. It's what matters more than just receiving your black belt, yeah? So I received my mastery at a very young age. And I just kept on and kept on learning. And I finally retired. I was in Paris, France with Steven Seagal doing a thing with him up there. And my knees were just completely blown out. I've had 23 knee operations on both my legs, completely wore them out through the arts. And I have now RA, rheumatoid arthritis, all over my body, especially within my knees. I got titanium in both my knees right now. I got titanium in my throat, some of my vertebrae in my neck that they had to replace. And so, you know, I had to retire. I had to stop doing what I was doing. Kind of like turn the page, you know.
Right.
It's time for another chapter.
So that's quite a history with him. And so you would travel with him and...
Yeah.
And
all over, everywhere.
Do exhibits and teach?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, it was fascinating.
So when that ended, what did you decide to do next?
I bought a gun. No, I didn't. I didn't. I scratched that. I've never owned a gun in my life. No, I I retired, but I retired from my business. Also, I was a hairdresser for many, many years. I owned and operated my own hair salon for many years. All my brothers and sisters did also. The funny thing about my brothers, I have a direct brother, Ernest Graywood, my sister, Judy, right? And then myself. We used to have a great coincidence about all of us. We're all born in August. We're all 2 years apart. We were all barbers, and we were all married to a pet. We didn't plan it that way. It just happened. But what was your question on that?
What did you decide? What direction did you then take?
Yeah, well, what I decided to do once I retired completely, which was the year 2000, where I was off the payroll of any type, I got a disability retirement. And I decided to follow my passion, which was one of the things that my mother taught me when I was very young, and that was to become an artist. My mother she loved to paint and draw and do a lot of sculptures and whatnot. So I followed her pathway, and I followed my passion. That's what I've always wanted, to become an artist, and always wanted to do that. And I was able to do that now. I'm able to do that now. So we have a store at the Trade Center, Corpus Christi Trade Center, and all the funds go towards building for this monument. But I get to do my artwork, and that frees me. You know, as I'm painting or drawing, if I'm doing an eagle, I become the eagle. If I'm painting a wolf, I become the wolf, you know, and I feel the needs and the cries and the pain of the wolf, you know, and along with the warriors and some of the holy men and medicine men that I've painted, you know, you get a part of the ownership to it that wow, you created this, you made this, and it's a part of you, you know. It's hard to explain unless you're an artist, I guess.
You do ceremonies with many Indians across the nation.
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell us about that a little bit, how you got involved in what you do now?
I've been doing ceremonies for many, many years, and the Lipan Apache people, I'm not Lipan. In fact, I don't even like to, supposedly my father was Mescalero Apache, but I can't say that I'm Mescalero because then I become a representative of the Mescalero people, and I don't want to do that. So I just claim myself as an Apache, yeah, or a Salagi or Cherokee. What was the question? I'm sorry.
What you do now with the ceremonies and how you join in.
The Lipan Apache knew that I was doing a lot of sunrise ceremonies every morning, and I had a drum circle at the library over at Janet Hart Library in Flower Bluff. It's still going on. I passed it over to somebody else, and I did that. I was there once a week from 1988 up until last year. I did a drum circle every week, every single week. Never missed a day. Never missed a week. And this elder came up to me and says, we want to do a very first coming of age ceremony in Corpus or in Texas. There hasn't been one since 150 years in the state of Texas. And we would like for you to conduct it. We would like for you. I said, I don't know anything about a coming of age ceremony. He says, I will teach you. And I would teach you how to do this, but I need you to help, you know, conduct it. And I said, absolutely. How was I going to say no, you know? So absolutely. So it was a lot of rigorous training and teachings and songs and things that I needed to learn. And we did it. We did our first coming of age ceremony. Our freedom of religion law was not passed. It was passed in 1973. If we would have conducted this ceremony in 1972, I would have faced 15 years federal penitentiary for each little girl that I did the ceremony for. And there were seven young ladies. And even at that, we still did it kind of hidden. For many years, the Apache people always would do their coming of age ceremony because it was illegal. It's always been illegal. We always did our coming of age ceremonies on the 4th of July because then everybody thought that we were celebrating the 4th of July. But our way, and it wasn't. It was coming of age ceremonies. And a coming of age ceremony is basically like a quinceañera where the young lady's coming of her age, and we need to, she's becoming the blessed one, and what we call the white painted woman, and she's becoming a woman, and she's caught between two worlds from a child to a young lady. So we counsel them. We sit in what was called a sacred teepee, and the ceremony is for 4 days and 4 nights, and we're constantly singing them songs. And there's only me, the elder, and the seven young ladies and their sponsors in the teepee. Nobody else can go in there for 4 days and 4 nights. And on the last day, they come out and they do their run, what's called a run. And running, they may fall, and we teach them to get up because in life we will fall. Mm-hmm. And to dust yourself up and to keep going. They're taught many, many things of wisdom of what can happen while they're growing up and how to take care of themselves and how to teach people the way you want to be treated, you know, because we teach people the way we want to be treated every day, all day long. And so we counsel them. I'm counseling them constantly, day in and day out. And then at the end of that, you know, the ceremony's over. They become the blessed one. Now they go out. That now they can come out and bless the people that have come to celebrate with them. They become the blessed one. So we had invited the Corpus Christi Collar Times, and they came out and did a story about it. And it was a beautiful story that they did on it. That was the start of my, of me doing ceremonies for the people, and I just kept on. I've done hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of burials where I bury people or do their what's called a spirit release ceremony. After a year, you had asked me about this. After a year that one has crossed, of taking their journey, we believe that their spirits lingers on for about a year to finish up unfinished business. And then we don't speak of them. We don't bring up their names at all. And at the end of the year, on the day of, we release their spirit. So now they can go home. And you can tell that they have been received because you'll see a falling star. And that means that they have been received by the spirit people. So their soul comes back to the earth, but their spirit stays with the star people. We are not in tape.
We are. We're good. I was just checking. All right. Very good. I guess Lapan Apaches are in McAllen. Do you ever go down and do anything with them?
I try not to. Lipans are from Canada all the way down to central Mexico.
Okay.
Apache people are from Canada all the way down into central Mexico. They've always been here. Lipans, there's a lot of them that kind of colonized and are here in South Texas. But the Lipans that you're referring to, they are known to people as the Lipan Apache tribe. But here in Corpus Christi, we have the Lipan Apache band. In the old days, there was only Apache bands, never a tribe, you know. This gentleman named Robert Soto kind of split off and wanted to do his own thing and make the Lipan Apache not federally recognized, but state recognized. And every 10 years, I have to go back to Austin and contest it and regain it back every 10 years. It's nothing that's given to them forever. And they're not federally, they're only state.
Being a Native American from Texas who had... who was harsh with the public lands towards the Native Americans. Do you think that Texas has changed its attitudes, or is it still...
Can I say bad words? No.
are your views on that?
Not only no, but hell no. Okay. Texas has never appreciated Indian people. From the time that it became Texas...
I've tried to eradicate.
Even my people, you know, my own, the Salazar side of my people. We took on a Hispanic survival name. In my case, was Salazar. We learned the religion, the culture, the language, and the ways of the Mexican people, so that we can remain here among the bones of our ancestors. But most of our people were either shot on sight, or pushed into the mountains of Mexico, or put in America's first prisoner of war camps. Back then they were known as agencies. Now they're known as Indian reservations. But those were the prisoner of war camps. And they made sure that they cleared Texas completely of Indian people. It wasn't too long ago that they decided to give some land to some of the nations. They just gave the Kickapoos are the most recent ones, I would say about maybe 30 years or 50 years, that they just recently gave them some land. But they used to live underneath the freeways. They used to live in tents. But the Kickapoos, they're from New York. You know, they're not even from Texas, you know. And if you go over to Livingston, Texas, the Alabama Cachada is just right there outside of Houston. And obviously they're from Alabama. No. And then you got the Tiquas and Tarahumanos over in Apache people over in El Paso, Texas, and they're from New Mexico. So none of them are from Texas, is what I'm trying to say. You know, so they made sure that there was no Indians in the state of Texas, to the point to where even if you were either Indian or if you were Mexican, on your birth certificate you were known as a white person. There is not an Indian person that was born in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s in their birth certificate that says if they're Mexicans or if they're Indians, on their birth certificate, it'll say that they're white people. I promise you.
I did not know that.
I promise you. Look it up. And some of our elders had said that probably the reason that they did that was because they wanted to make Texas a very powerful, very strong nation, state. So the more whites they can get down here, the better. So what people would do up north is that, hey, you know, I hear that they're giving away land in Texas. How many white people are living down there? Well, just look at the Census Bureau. Huh, look at all these. Let's go down there. Yeah.
Interesting, yeah. So, there's a large variety of Native American people across the Northern America, and they have different spiritual beliefs. Mm-hmm. And is there any particular group that you feel closer to, or that you have strong opinions about?
I have strong opinions about the probably some of the Lakota people. You know, those are the Plain Indians. I mean, I respect them. I love them all. But, you know, I'm not a Plains Indian. I'm a Desert Indian.
Okay.
You know, we learn whatever we can. Down here, we were very limited into what we can learn and what we can pick up. And there's a lot of Indian people today that are becoming strong Indians, but it's a romantic notion of what they have picked up in Hollywood. You know, television has screwed up our people so badly. And not only our people, but everybody else too. You know, I have so many people that even just yesterday, you know, people come up to me and they go, how? You know, that's so stupid. That is just so stupid. But that's ignorance that people just don't realize what they're doing, you know. And I'm going to use that one just for example, the word, you know, the how, the way they raise up their hand. To us, that's a sign of Christ. They think it's a sign of stupidity or a sign of Hollywood that's how you got to greet an Indian person, you know. And people come up to me and they say, yatta hey. They just yell it out, yatta hey. I automatically start thinking, okay, this guy just got through watching a John Wayne movie, you know. Automatically, just, you know, because that's what they used to use a lot. My mother never used to let me watch John Wayne or any of the Western movies because she hated the way that our people were treated in television, you know. But television has screwed up so many people so badly about the Indian culture, you know.
Very much so.
Plenty of other cultures, too.
That's true. You want to ask about the monument?
Yes. Would you tell the story of the Ishka Monument?
Yeah, absolutely. In 1994, it was January the 14th of 1994, I was taking a nap that day. And I received a phone call from the Corpus Christi Caller Times from a writer by the name of Max Baer. Not a relation to a native people at all. It just happens to be Max Baer. And he says, Mr. Running Turtle, what if I were to tell you that over on Ennis Joselyn, because at that time they were widening the street to make it wider because Texas A&M was growing bigger there. And in Corpus Christi, it was growing bigger, so they needed that extra flow of traffic. It was going from a two-lane to a four-lane, and they came across a burial site. He said, what if I were to tell you that they came across a burial, and it's a 14-year-old young lady that's carbon-dated 500 years, that's a Comanche. She was in a fetal position, and she had all these funerary objects all the way around her as to how they were determined that she was Comanche. And she was facing the east, which is the proper way, and they're pulling her out right now. You know, what do you think about that? I said, well, I'm on my way. So Mr. Max Baer literally thought that I was going to go over there and raise hell, bring my war drums and my tomahawks and, be very upset. I was upset, but not to the extreme of being violent. Thank God for my martial arts discipline. It teaches me otherwise, yeah. So anyway, when I arrived, I was there with my tobacco to do a ceremony. I was there with my drum to sing a song for forgiveness. And the archaeologists on site saw me pulling over to the side of the freeway, off the street. I was across the street, and she put her hand out like, stop, don't move. And then she yelled across the street. She says, you can't come over here. And I said, why? She goes, because you're not allowed. I said, why? It's a public street. It's a public sidewalk. He says, not right now, it's not. She says, this is a delicate situation. I said, I know what y'all are doing. I've come to do my ceremony. And she said, that's not going to happen. So she said, you stay right there where you're at, or the police will pick you up. I said, okay. So right there where I was standing, I did my ceremony. And I sang my songs, I offered tobacco, and I offered forgiveness for the soul of that young lady that they had desecrated her burial site. And that evening, that day I went home, and I had a hard time sleeping. I kept thinking about it and thinking about it. So I came back to the site, and it was blocked, and it was, crime tape around it, because I have to treat it like a crime scene when they find bones of any type. And so it was taped off, and so I went to the park, which was real close to where that burial site was, and I was right in the middle of the park, and I was looking up to the stars. This was about 12 o'clock midnight at nighttime. I looked up to the stars, and I'm singing songs and forgiveness, and I had my pipe, and I was smoking and sending my prayers up. And I shut up for a while. I just stood completely still, and I faced the east, and I felt the wind in my face. I turned to the south, and I felt more wind, because the winds do come in from the southeast. And then I turned to the west, and I'm very, very quiet and just listening. I turned to the south, not to the north, and I did the same thing, and then looked straight up to Christ, to God, to the star people, to the spirit people. And then when I went down on my knee to touch the earth to tell her I'm sorry, I heard a voice. And I stood up and I said, I promise that I will always bless these grounds for as long as I'm still on this earth walk, until they bring all my people back to their original burial sites. Do you need to attend to that?
I'll exit once.
Okay. Okay, we're going to continue on with...
So when I touched the ground and I heard that voice, and I stood up, and I promise that from this day on, for as long as I'm on this earth walk, I will do a ceremony for the spirit of that young lady. I didn't even know that at that time that was an entire burial site. At that time, I just knew that it was one burial site. So then this was what had happened, came out on the news the following day. A friend of mine that read it, he wasn't a friend then, he read the article from Austin. His name is Dr. Fred McGee. He's an archaeologist. He's also half Cherokee, and he's also half black. right? Beautiful man. He contacted me and he said, Larry, we need to talk. I said, sure. He came down. He says, the whole Ennis Jocelyn is a burial site, Indian burial site. I said, it is. He says, yes. I said, well, I was speaking to the spirit people and they told me that I needed to do the ceremony for them. And I'm going to do it. He says, you have every right to do that. He said, he says, there's more to it than what you think it is. So then as an archaeologist, he was able to bring me more statistics. And we found out that in 1933, there was a real big hurricane that hit and it revealed right along Ennis Jocelyn, closer to Ocean Drive and the university. It revealed 150 bodies that day. And they knew that at that time, you know, there were, Ennis Jocelyn was known as Rabbit Run at that time. And so they were, or no, it was known as Oso, right? Oso?
Yeah, Oso Bay.
Oso Bay, that's what it was. Rabbit Run was where I used to live. It's now Greenwood Street. Anyway, Oso Bay, they were making it larger, and they found out that there was more and more burial sites. And so he brought me all this statistics that, from as an archaeologist point of view, I was like, damn, I didn't realize that. He says, oh, yeah. And he kept on bringing me more and more and more. So I got the whole book that I got from TxDOT, which is about that thick, of all the burial sites throughout Ennis Jocelyn. And there's thousands of them, thousands. And they're still, you know, they just build some apartments there. Every time they build something or put a stop sign somewhere, anytime, even us, when we were putting the sign up that a future site for our American Indian Monument, we were using the post hole digger. We pulled out a human tooth.
Good grief.
Yeah, and that was at the park. So that whole area is very alive as far as burial site is concerned. So we decided back then what I was trying to do first was to rename the street because I knew that it was also at one time Bear, and then they changed it to Ennis Jocelyn, which is the guy that I think he had put a lot of money into the dam, the building of the dam, and also. So they commemorated him that way. And I said, well, I think we're going to name this street to Sacred Spirit Trail Street. And I got some petitions and I went door to door and tried to get people to sign off on it. Everybody slammed their doors on me. Everybody cursed me off their land. And I got maybe 3 signatures from visiting people that didn't even know the whole place. But some of the residents there just didn't care for me at all. So I was telling Dr. McGee, you know, what do I do? What do I do? You know, we need to commemorate these people with, you know, just doing a ceremony once a month. I said, these are all forgotten people. Everybody forgot about these people, you know. I said, I think I want to build a monument here, but not just a monument. And I think I'm way over my head, but I want to build a huge monument. And the monument that I picked was by Dave McGarry. Did y'all get to research him, Dave McGarry? Beautiful work. Oh, my God, he does something. But he passed away. He died. He became a very good friend of mine. And I've had dinner with him at we've gone to ceremonies, he and I together, and he ended up dying of a heart attack. God, that killed me. That just hurt me. But his wife said that they could still build a monument because he left the cast behind.
Very good.
And he does some magnificent work. They had one in it. I don't know if you guys ever got to go to the Astrodome. There was one in front of the Astrodome called Touch the Clouds. And he had his hands. He was covered up with a buffalo robe and he's looking up like that. His name was Touch the Clouds, but they moved it because they're tearing down the Astrodome. So they moved Touch the Clouds to Oklahoma. And in fact, I was trying to buy it so we can bring it down to Corpus and somebody already had overbid me. So we decided to pick out another monument. And the monument that I picked out, there was a lot of people, a lot of controversy about it, you know, because this guy with a full headdress and, you know, and everybody was like, why are you picking him? You know, you should have picked a Carrancoa or a Tancoa or some of the local native. There was the Migaitos, the Malacaitos, native people that lived in those areas. You know, why didn't you pick those? And I said, well, you know, those people are long gone. This is a visiting holy man visiting the site. And it made sense, you know, because I want people to come down and visit this sacred site and see the sacredness that our people saw before they were buried. Yeah? Yeah. So the statue cost us $300,000. Mm-hmm. You know, we got like, since we just built the medicine wheel over there where the statue is going to stand, and I put a big dent in our savings because we had like $34,000. Now I got like $23,000. So we're still trying to raise money for that.
Oh, well, good. Tell us about the medicine wheel. What does it signify?
The medicine wheel is a plains, but not just a plains medicine wheel. Because you find one in Wyoming. Wyoming has one of the first big medicine wheels that they ever came across, made, you know, many, many years ago. But there's medicine wheels all over the world. They're just all over the world. But it's a wheel with a circle and a cross in the center that divides the north, east, south, and west. And you have to learn how to walk the wheel because each position of the wheel brings in certain medicines to heal you spiritually. You know, a lot of people get sick with diabetes, with this, with that. You know, they get sick like that, you know. And a lot of the sickness that we get is from anger that we're hestering, problems that we're storing away. And we become hoarders of all these bad things that we choose to keep around us. So then it becomes an illness. So before you treat the illness, you must treat the spirit because you have a broken spirit. This medicine wheel, going to the medicine wheel, learning how to use the medicine wheel will be the beginning pathway of healing your spirit before you heal the body. Yeah.
Good.
So how, you said to walk the medicine wheel?
Yeah. You and I are going to walk it someday.
Okay.
And I will teach you how.
Okay.
To explain it to you, we would need another 5 hours.
5 hours. All right.
I promise you.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm going to hold to it.
Okay.
Rituals and their meanings. Do you think that's, as you were speaking about that, I was thinking the healing rituals have meanings, and how do you, I think you just described it a little bit, but maybe could you go into a little more depth how it differs from modern medicine?
Mm.
You
know? Modern medicine, it's just a Band-Aid. And they're doing that so that the drug companies can make a living. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not out to heal people. They're out to prolong their illnesses. You know, and everybody's healing, they're trying to heal the cause of the illness, but the cause of the illness starts with the spirit. The cause of the illness starts with forgiveness. Forgiveness. You know, the cause of the illness starts from letting go of these things that we harbor around, you know, and you can heal somebody from cancer. You can heal somebody from all these sicknesses that they're carrying around. But as long as they're harboring this stuff, other stuff around, they're going to revisit it again and again and again until they're taken out of the equation. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, these are the ways of our people. And we study the animals as to what plants they ate. The bear, when you see a bear, and they're the closest to man and woman in this continent, where we don't have any primates down here, but, you know, Africa, they have their own closest relatives over there. But here, the closest one was the bear because it stood up. And when it stands up, all of his insights line up exactly like yours and mine. all the insides. So after they've woken up from a long sleep during their hibernation, sometimes they woke up feeling sick or weak or tired or just not well. So our people would study them as to what plants, what roots, what bark they ate. And if they can eat it, we can eat it. If that helped them heal, it'll help us heal. Every time there was a poisonous plant, just a few feet away from it will be the answer. Yeah.
Have you done any research, or has anybody done research regarding the way the land was, like 2,000 years ago? I think you had mentioned that one of the earliest people at the Ishka site was 2,000 years old.
Carbon dating, well, some of the bones that I've come across, in fact, one of the most recent ones was on, what's the name of that street, McCardle? I can't remember right now. There was another burial site just a few hundred, maybe about less than a mile away from Ennis Joslyn. We found seven bodies there, and those bodies were 13 BC.
Wow.
Yeah.
I guess what I'm trying to understand is, was the sea level lower, which made that more of a dry land area?
That's an archaeology question. I don't know about that. You know, that I don't know. I don't know.
Okay.
We would love to have you play the flute and the drums. Is there any other topics you would like to introduce before playing the instrument?
Well, these are healing songs that I will play. They're not just songs for the enjoyment of the ear or the spirit, but these are healing songs. These are medicine songs. These are songs that have been passed down from generation to generation for thousands of years. Not a single note, not a single beat has been changed, nor the words to it. And there are our origins. There are our teachings come through songs. Our teachings come through the flute. But these are very much healing songs that I bring to you.
Very good.
I'll do the flute first, if you don't mind. In the morning, we do an offering. I have a lot of people that come up to me and say, I'm having so much trouble with, spirits, at home. I see things moving. I feel somebody next to me, and I'm like, well, spirit people are always around us. They always are, and they always will be. I always tell people, if we all only knew the spirit person that walked next to us, we would never fear anything ever again, because they're there to help us. But because it's the fear of the unknown, we make it bad. I tell people that there's a difference between spirit and ghost. A ghost is from up here in your head. Spirit is from here in your heart. Yeah. So we watch a lot of movies. We read a lot of horror. We hear a lot of terror. So we feed our souls into that. And that's what comes out of us within dreams. That's what comes out of us within fear. Yeah. So when there's a spirit person or persons in a room that are doing such things, they're asking for an offering. A song is an offering. A prayer, when you sit and pray to God, that's an offering. What did Lillian Tomlin say one time? When we pray, that's us talking to God. When we listen, that's God talking to us. And it's very much true that, we have to just listen, just shut up and listen. And the spirit people are there to guide us, to help us. And so are the animal spirits. They're there to help us. Animal has always wanted to be friend to man. But we have to make the greater effort. We want to be victorious over everything. And we should all be equal to everything, not victorious. You know, we respect women. Indian people respect their women where other cultures didn't do that, you know. We respected animals, you know, we treated them as equals, where other cultures didn't do that, you know. They wanted to be victorious over all animals, you know. And that's not the way spirit works, you know. So this is an offering song that I do in the mornings for my people. The interesting thing about the flute was nobody taught me. The doves taught me. I would sit outside every morning because I really wanted to learn how to play a flute. I didn't know who could teach me how to play a flute. I didn't know anybody that played the flute. The birds knew how to play the flute. And that's what I mean. Our people learn from the animals. You know, I come in here and I see these library books and there's tons of education here. You know, where I see the age of our people, our education was outside, the trees, the animals, the birds, the water, the clouds. Those were all that was our teachings out there. So the birds, you know, I would replicate the dove. So I just kept on and kept on and kept on. And when I would find a note that I liked, I kept it and I would add it to my repertoire. And I kept it and I kept it. And then other people came around and finally they started teaching me songs of the old ones, the songs, the canyon music, if you will, on some of the ceremonies for sunrise ceremonies. Yeah.
The kind of trilling sound, what bird would that be?
That was that's not a bird, actually. No, that's the sound of a windmill.
Okay. Because in English-style flute, it's called tonguing.
Oh.
And so I was wondering if it had an animal that went with that.
No. This is an all buffalo drum. I'll do a morning song, a Cherokee morning song. When day ho, when day ho, when day ya, when day ya, ho 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 ho. Hey oh, ya ya ya. Windy ah oh, windy ah oh, windy ah, windy ah. Oh 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 oh, hey oh, ya ya ya. You've heard this song. No? Yes? I'll sing another song. Usually I come out in the morning and the stars are still out. Yeah? because I waited for the sun to come out. And so I get to talk to my ancestors. We have a belief that when we pass away, we go back to the becoming part of the star people. Yeah. So when we die, we believe that you adopt part of the stars to become one of your relatives. You know, like a cousin can become the North Star, or an aunt can become the Eastern Star, and you know, or the Orion Belt, you know, or whatever the Dipper
constellation.
All of those have a meaning for some Native person that adopted it. You know, that's now my uncles right there. These are my aunts over here. So when you want to talk to your relatives, they're there. You know, your neighbor, your whoever has crossed on, they're there. And all you got to do is come out and talk to them. You know, we say that if you want to, I always talk to a lot of women that they're constantly giving their power away. You know, they come in, oh, this person hates me, or this person's mad at me, or this person, you know, is disrespecting me. I tell them, you know, what you need to do is regain your powers. Quit giving your power away. You know, you're constantly giving your power away to these people. What they say, what they think about you is none of your business. You need to regain your power. And the way to do that is wait for the full moon. All the grandmothers are there. All grandmothers from the beginning of time, all the grandmothers are there. My grandmother's there. Everybody's grandmother's there. Face the grandmothers. Talk to them. If you haven't spoken to your grandmother, or they're there waiting for y'all. They're waiting for all of us to go up there and just shut up. Just shut up and just turn off all this technologic things that's going on in your mind and just listen to your grandmother. She's got things to tell you, you know, and she's got teachings for you, and you'll regain, ask her for your powers. You will regain your powers back. So I sing a song, it's called Stargazing Song, yeah? And in the middle of the song, I speak in English. Because I used to sing this song a lot for the drum group that I was involved in, and a lot of them were speaking English people. So I would, as they would continue singing the song and harmonizing in the background, I would go off and pray as the song. It was just part of the song. You'll see what I'm talking about. Oh, spirit people, I come to you with a heavy heart. Today, I have lost a friend. I ask you to accept them in your council table of the star people. Collect him, and grant them security there among our ancestors and our ancient ones. Send back a star and let us know that you have received them in a good way. And for this, we sing you these songs of the old ones. Oh-ay-ya, hey-ya. Oh-ay-ya, hey-ya, yo. Oh-ay-ya, hey-ya. Oh-ay-ya, hey-ya, yo. Hey, yo, hey. Oh, that one I did for you.
Thank you. That was very nice. I like that. It's been a pleasure and an honor to talk with you today, Running Turtle. We thank you so much for coming and sharing your history and your ideas and your beliefs. Mm. Is there anything else you would like to say at the...
Well, if any of the students that are listening to this, or anybody else that ever listens to this, If they decide they want to go off and talk to a holy man, a medicine man, or man of wisdom, or any native person that they have respect for, that they bring tobacco and they offer them tobacco. And this way, an offering of tobacco means that they won't tell you anything, but with that, the silent conversation about that is that, would you pray for my people? Would you pray for my ancestors? Would you, everywhere you go, spread your tobacco and think of my people when you do this? So, people need to learn these things. You know, this is a teachings that need to go on. And everything that I've talked to you all about today and that you all are listening to today, it's not for you to keep. It is for you to share so that these teachings can go on.
Well, that's what we're here for. We want to share your information and to keep it alive. And so what, if we can help in any way, please allow us to.
You already are.
And
this is a big help right here.
And we respect you and thank you very much.
Bravo. Thank you.
Ishka, which means until we meet again.
And we will.
Okay.
We will.
Thank you very much.
Bravo.